countdown shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And look, it's today. It's the 23rd of July in the glorious future year of 2022. The 204th day of the year, in case you're keeping track. I actually prefer serially numbering the days of the year. That's my favorite date convention, but... it does leave you with the question of, well, what day is the anniversary of another day if one of them falls in a leap year and the other doesn't? So what do I have to talk about today? Well, I guess I could talk about a lot of things. For example, I could talk about the insanity of the ongoing gas crisis. Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commissioner, is telling European countries that they'd better make plans to do without Russian gas this winter. Just exactly how they're going to do that is unclear, considering the significant economic pain that the EU countries are already in from the cutbacks they've had to make. You know, the Russians haven't stopped delivering gas. The Nord Stream 1 pipeline was idle for several days recently because some equipment had to be replaced. And it's been delivering at only about 40% capacity because one of its compressor turbines is in Canada being repaired. You'll see this described as Siemens turbine. It's actually a Rolls-Royce turbine. Siemens bought the turbine unit in question, the compressor turbocompressor division, off of Rolls-Royce and then spun it off again into what's now called Siemens Energy. So it's described some places as a Siemens turbine, but it's really a Rolls-Royce turbine. But it's been being repaired and refurbished, really, in Canada. Well, a group of Ukrainian Canadians, who are a fairly important political lobby in Canada, have filed suit with the Canadian against the Canadian government to block the re-exportation of it on the grounds that there's no justification for the one-time loophole that was created in the Canadian sanctions against Russia to allow the thing to be shipped back and reinstalled. Tin says that the turbine is now in Germany. I don't know how that affects the Ukrainians' lawsuit. I was reading about this, I think, in the paper last week. Anyway, I don't know how that affects the Ukrainian Canadians and their lawsuit. It's really a last-ditch effort anyway. But you probably didn't even hear that a gas terminal in the United States is shut down because it blew up. Yes, at the beginning of June, there was an explosion and fire in a liquefied natural gas export terminal in South Texas. And fortunately, none of the expensive stuff was damaged. This happened in the piping that runs from the liquefied natural gas storage tanks to the berths where the tankers are actually filled. But they don't know why it happened, and so it's not just a case of making quick repairs. It's going to be shut down for several months while they figure out what happened and why, because, of course, they don't want to put it back into operation only to have the very same thing happen again. Now, this had an interesting effect on the natural gas market in the United States, or fossil methane market in the United States, really, which was that the price, which was at a 14-year high at the beginning of June, fell by half and has now recovered most of where it was. That we're now back up to $8 per million British thermal units. The high was more like 9, was a bit above 9, but we're back up at 8 after falling to somewhere in the region of 4 only a few weeks ago. A big part of that, of course, is the large demand for electricity owing to the pervasive heat waves, and the fact that as more electricity is called for, peaking plants get brought on stream, peaking plants which are less efficient than baseload plants. They can only operate when there's high demand for electricity, and thus, in market areas, high wholesale electricity prices, because they have much higher costs of operation. But they have relatively low capital costs, either because they're cheap straight-through gas turbines, or because they're old, obsolete plants that were paid off a long time ago, and so they can sit most of the year, just being maintained. Anyway, so yeah, when the demand for electricity goes up, the demand for gas doesn't go up linearly. It actually goes up more rapidly than the demand for electricity, which is interesting. I mean, I will continue to observe that if Comanche Peak 3 and 4, 1,700 megawatts each, and South Texas 3 and 4, 1,600 megawatts each, had actually gone ahead. You know, they were proposed in 2008. If they had actually gone ahead, in fact, the government was offering loan guarantees to new nuclear projects at that time, but only a handful of them. Two of them went to VC Summer in Carolina, which has since been canceled, abandoned, and the other two went to Georgia's Vogtle project. But, you know, if those plants were in operation, the Texas grid would be much more stable, and power prices in Texas would be much lower, and demand for gas in Texas would be much lower. And, of course, Texas doesn't want to burn gas. Texas wants to sell it to other people. Just the same way as the United Arab Emirates built the Barakah nuclear power station, because they don't want to burn gas, they want to sell it to somebody else. Well, so much for that, all right? Fuel shortages, power shortages, these are not good things, but they mostly won't kill you. Yeah, you might freeze. You might die of heat stroke. But those are fairly unlikely, fairly easy to avoid in most conditions. They're not that big of a danger. Water shortage, on the other hand? If you don't have water, you're going to die. That's all there is to it. And Port Elizabeth, South Africa, in the East Cape, is suffering from exactly that problem. Now, this is not a new problem. The monsoon rains on which they depend for their fresh water supply have been dwindling year upon year for more than a decade. They could have conserved water, right? As in many places, the water that goes into the water system, only about half actually comes out of the taps because of lots of broken and leaky pipes. So they've had a decade in which they could have reduced the amount of water drawn from the reservoirs, thus helping to keep the reservoirs more filled even when there was no rain. But they haven't done that. And what else haven't they done? Well, the Electricity Supply Commission, Eskom, the electric utility in South Africa, has signally failed to do the thing that they've had a decade now to do, and a decade in which it's very clear that they needed to do this. Now, Eskom operates a lot of thermal power plants. So a couple of years ago, there was a serious water shortage in Cape Town. Now, Cape Town, in addition to coal-fired power plants, also has the Kooiberg nuclear station. Any thermal power station that's cooled by seawater can be retrofitted with evaporators for making fresh water from the sea. That's the thing. Any thermal power station cooled by the sea can be retrofitted with evaporators for making fresh water from seawater. You lose a little bit of power and gain quite a lot of water. In the sense that power shortages make people angry and upset, and they lead to economic disruptions. Water shortages really just plain kill people. Power riots are nothing compared to water riots. And so we have to ask, why has ESCOM not acted? Why have the local water utilities, right, not gone through and replaced and repaired the damaged and leaking piping? When they knew that the result would be water shortages. What's going on here? It's hard to understand. You know, 25 years ago, it wouldn't have been as hard to understand. The National Party government, you have to realize, apartheid was not just about blacks versus whites. They had a bunch of categories, right? There were the blacks in the cities. There were the blacks in the Bantustans. There were the Indians. There were the coloreds, who are another community, right? And so they had to use a whole lot of effort on repressing the whites who didn't agree, the blacks, and, you know, playing off the different groups against each other bought you something, but there is an enormous cost in manpower and resources of turning yourself into a police state, which is essentially what they were doing. That's what the National Party was doing. It was wasting enormous amounts of manpower directly, right, in making, you know, policing repression, that is to say, and manufacturing weapons for repression. It was wasting raw materials and industrial capacity in manufacturing weapons for repression. And even more than that, there was enormous indirect waste of manpower in the form of not allowing people from the less favored communities, not allowing blacks and coloreds and Indians who were capable of it to be trained and educated and take on positions of social and economic responsibility. Because the Afrikaners just claimed that they were none of them capable. And so all positions had to be filled with Afrikaners, and there not being enough Afrikaners for all these positions, they only comprise about 5% of the population of the country, then anything that couldn't be done by an Afrikaner just had to be left undone. They kind of wanted to pretend that the English-speaking whites didn't exist. The Afrikaners would rather be in control than be prosperous. That's sort of their whole ethos. They want the whole pie, no matter how small it is. Frankly, I regard them as the most useless group of people I've ever heard of, almost. But I'm not here to rag on the Afrikaners. I'm here to ask the question. Once the lid was taken off, once it was no longer impossible for people to get jobs and get education unless they were of the right race background, once all that manpower and raw material and industrial capacity was no longer having to be wasted on repression, why hasn't South Africa become a lot more prosperous? Because the thing was, in 1995, South Africa was definitively the most prosperous sub-Saharan African nation. And I guess it still is, but not as much as you would expect. This is the question. Why has South Africa not become more prosperous? Why have they not at least done the obvious things that it was clear they would have to do, that everybody knew they would need to do? Repairing the water systems is the first step, right? Repairing the water systems in Cape Town, repairing the water systems in the Port Elizabeth area, and then acknowledging that there are unfavorable long-term trends in precipitation, adding evaporator units to their existing thermal power stations. I mean, I'm not even asking why they haven't gone ahead with their large planned nuclear program, which was supposed to, among other things, eliminate the need for shipping trainloads of coal to the East Cape from the central mining areas. I'm not even asking that. This is a very unsatisfactory situation. The only thing I can guess is that the ANC people, African National Congress people, were, because of the many years they spent in a revolutionary struggle, not terribly well prepared for the administrative business of actually running the country, but that the people in the country, by and large, feel too much of a moral debt to them for those decades of struggle to pick anybody else to run the country. And they probably don't have a lot of really attractive options anyway. But you would think that people in power, in the political parties, would start realizing, oh, hey, there's stuff that needs to be done, and I'm not any good at doing it. I need to hire somebody who is. And when I say that, I'm not coming up with some idealized version of politics, all right? I'm thinking of a very specific matter. You know who ran a lot of the New Deal projects for the Franklin Roosevelt administration? Herbert Hoover. Literally, the reviled outgoing president, hated by people for not doing more than he did, the guy they just won an election against? Yeah, they turned around and hired Hoover because everybody knew he was a really good administrator. He was really good at administering things like construction projects, mining projects, basically the whole public works deal. So, of course, also, there's the obvious question, what are people's priorities? Because you'd think that having adequate drinking water would be a high priority for most people. Because, as I said, you can't live without it. So why have the ordinary people not been putting pressure on their political leaders to do something about this? What other priorities have the people been looking at instead? What other priorities have the politicians been looking at instead? Tin from Berlin says, there's a Hoover school right next to my mom's house. Yeah, well, of course, that was because Herbert Hoover was the guy who made sure Europe didn't starve to death in 1918, 1919, 1920. You know, I've often said he ought to be considered the patron saint of the European Union, because if you think that Europe in the 1920s and 1930s descended into horrifying, you know, politics and really bad things, well, they sure did. There's no doubting that. But if it hadn't been for the massive food relief that Hoover organized, there wouldn't be a European civilization today, okay? There wouldn't have been a Second World War in Europe because you wouldn't have been able to figure out who was fighting who. I don't know. That's, that's my thought about it. But anyway, so yeah, I do really, I've been putting together this Man at Adam briefing book, which I've talked about repeatedly, and I've been putting together graphs, you know, looking at global final energy consumption by source. Total global primary energy supply by source. Electricity generation by source. And along with the graphs that I've been drawing based on this data, I'm using, you know, readily available information. I've been going to the OECD IEA Key World Statistics, of course. Also to the IAEA power reactors in the world. To a certain extent, I'm going to have to fall back on the BP World Energy Report, although, of course, everybody's different in what statistics they tabulate and how they tabulate them. But, you know, it's very clear, anybody who talks about, oh, well, we're going to decarbonize the world with... This is a hard road to hoe, folks. It really is. I guess I should mention, by the way, the French and Russian language films. Did I mention them last week? Anyway, that you can look at tubenix.org, look for the Man and Atom channel to see the new films that are up. But let me read you some of the text that I've got here. Let's see. And SMJ, our beloved SMJ, pointed me at somebody's Twitter feed. They've got a Patreon, somebody who's really strong campaigning for a nuclear green deal. I'm going to have to get in touch with this person, see if we can coordinate our efforts at all. But let me read you some of the sort of flavor text that I've written to go along with these graphs. Because I think some of it is extremely relevant just at this moment. So, I'm experimenting with page layouts. So, for example, I've got one layout which is two large columns, and then on the left-hand side, because this is the... So the graphs and other color illustrations are on the right-hand pages, and then there's text on the left-hand pages. And so I have this set up so that at the left margin of the left page, there's a larger, bold text block, which is narrower, and then two broad columns. So the large text I have... I'm still working on this, obviously. It needs a lot of work, but I'm going to read you some of it. Energy is very nearly all things to all men, the silent servant, the universal substitute raw material, and the sine qua non of technic civilization. Fundamentally, it is the means of causing changes in the physical world. These changes can be as subtle as the closing of a switch, smaller than a wavelength of visible light, as gentle as taking the chill off a room, as blatant as hauling a 100-car string of 100-ton railway cars at 100 kilometers an hour, or as magnificent as hurling a spacecraft right out of the solar system. Understanding energy requires attention to how it is used and what people want it for, as well as where it comes from. So, you got to understand the layout here. On the left, so first spread, there's a left-hand page and the right-hand page. The right-hand page has total world primary energy supply. There's two pie graphs, one for 1973, one for 2019. They're divided up showing the sources of world energy supply, and they're scaled so that the areas of each corresponding pie wedge are exactly comparable. In other words, the area of the 1973 circle has the same proportion to the area of the 2019 circle that the energy consumption of the 2 years has. And so I've got two quotes facing that page, and one is from the A World to Gain, the British socialist tract about the Geneva Conference of 1955, the bit that starts, "In round terms, you have today, 2,000 million brothers and sisters, and 100,000 more of them are born each day. Into what sort of world are they born? For most part, their lot is poverty and suffering." And then it ends up, "It is not surprising that the world of 1956 is not at peace with itself. There is no reason why it should be." And then the other quote on the page says, "Abundant energy drives economic development, which can raise a country's standard of living and ultimately improve the prospects for peace in a region." Anyway, it goes on from there. But then the next page, the one that I already read you the bit off of, the sort of sidebar, is facing the page that shows the final final utilization of energy. In other words, what form it's used by the consumer. Which is about 23%, 20% electricity, 20% electricity, 3% other today, 40% oil, 10% coal, lignite, and peat, 16% gas, 10% biofuels and waste. And I say, Tin says probably correlation rather than causation. I don't believe that, no. I think, you know, wars often start because people feel threatened, and the threat of famine, the threat of scarcity, is at the top of that. Another reason is people feel envy. If you're prosperous and your neighbor's prosperous, you have less reason to fight than when he's prosperous and you're not. But let me read you what I have facing the final consumption page, or at least a bit of it, because I think this is relevant. Half of all the energy consumed as oil is used in road transport. It's actually like 49.7%. When air, 8.6%, marine, 6.7%, and rail, 0.8% uses are added together, the total proportion demanded for transport is 65.3%. A further 7.3% of energy consumed as gas is used for transport. Interestingly, only about 1% of energy consumed as electricity is used for transport. I think electrification is really just really efficient. Electric rail, anyway. Electric cars, probably a lot less so. 5.3% of the energy consumed is oil, and 29.7% of that consumed as gas is used in residences, primarily for the daily needs of space heating, water heating, and cooking. A substantial portion of energy consumed as biofuels is likewise used in homes. The quantity of fuel used for domestic purposes outside the home, for cooking in restaurants, heating offices and shops, and so on, is of the same general magnitude. Together, oil and gas used in transport and the home account for 34.6% of world final energy consumption. This is 1.75 times the present electrical share of final demand, 19.7%. Simple arithmetic, admittedly an imperfect guide to the behavior of energy economies, says that substituting electricity for these fuels would require increasing world generation to 74,250 terawatts a year from the present 26,900. How is that to be supplied? Some relief comes from an unexpected quarter. The second law of thermodynamics. A well-known consequence of this principle of physics is that heat engines, which generate about three-fourths of all electricity, typically discharge more energy into the environment as heat than they supply as power. This represents fuel purchased, which the ratepayer gets no benefit from, so there is incentive to find some use for it. Alas, water warmed to 35 degrees C, a typical condenser temperature for steam power stations, finds few applications beyond keeping fishing spots ice-free in the winter. Again, in consequence of the second law, however, considerably more work is done in descending from 315 C, a typical steam temperature for water-cooled nuclear power reactors, to 175, than from 175 to 35, and more from 175 to 105 than from 105 to 35. As a result, by sacrificing a modest proportion of the electric output, a substantial quantity of heat can be taken off at a useful temperature. The unit cost of this heat is much lower than at the top of the thermodynamic cycle because it has mostly been paid for by the fraction transformed into electricity, a very high-value form of energy, on its way down. For a real-world example, at Betznau in Switzerland, 1 kilowatt-hour of electricity is given up per 8 kilowatt-hours of heat supplied at 120 degrees C to the Refuna network. This heat is transported as hot water under pressure through a 31 kilometer of pipeline and 101 kilometer of distribution mains, serving a considerable area. Over 120 gigawatt-hours of heat is distributed in a typical year from the two small, 365 megawatt rated electrical capacity each, antiquated, started up in 1969 and 71, PWR units. In the Czech Republic, a pipeline recently completed from the Temelin nuclear station to 1,000 megawatt PWRs is estimated to save the municipal heat system in Budějovice, 22 kilometers distant, some 70,000 tons of coal annually. And then I go into the use of this for air conditioning, because it can be used for air conditioning, and we desperately need that right now, and also for desalting. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you'd like to support me monetarily, paypal.me/PrometheusLives is a good option. Patreon.com/Publius_Reads. Coming up next is Tobe with the Dubious Goals Committee. Let's all hear it for Tobe on Anon Radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System 6.